Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. We've got a great show for you today, so stay tuned with us. We're going to start with some music, and I was just listening to some of my old CDs, one with John Lennon, and I was listening to this song and saying to myself, wow, this is a very appropriate song for the times we're living in. You know, the weird COVID situation and the world's government's reactions to it and the lockdowns and some of the other, you know, 1984 aspects of our current society. And, you know, John Lennon wrote this song called Nobody Told Me. And basically, you know, the chorus is, nobody told me there'd be days like these. And this he wrote, you know, way back. I guess maybe he wrote it in the late 70s and recorded it in the late 70s, but it actually didn't come out until after he died. It was sort of the last album, or at least the album that followed after his death that Yoko Ono, I think, produced. So we're going to start today with John Lennon's tune, Nobody Told Me.
Deep ball! Everybody's talking, no one says a word. Everybody's making love, no one really cares. There's Natchez in the bathroom, just below the stairs. Always something happening, nothing going on. There's always something cooking, nothing in the pot. They're starving back in China, so finish what you got.
Mama, roll!
And that was Nobody Told Me by John Lennon from the album Milk and Honey. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's basically CKUT's environmental radio show, and I am your host, Ryan Young. And last week, we covered a lot of stuff about residential schools and the recently discovered unmarked graves with children at some of these residential schools. So I thought today we would cover some of that material again. But first, there has been quite a lot of resistance to the construction of the Enbridge Line 3 tar sands pipeline, which is part of it goes through northern Minnesota. And there are a number of water protectors just last week that locked themselves to construction vehicles at two different work sites and to the pipeline itself. And of course, you know, there's been a huge movement against these pipelines for some time. And many of these movements are led by Indigenous people. And one of the people that Amy Goodman interviews in this segment is Tara Huska, who is a tribal attorney, a land defender, a sun dancer, and a former advisor on Native American affairs to Bernie Sanders. She is from the Kuchiching First Nation. Let's hear that story now from Democracy Now!
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Resistance to construction of the Enbridge Line 3 tar sands pipeline continued Thursday in northern Minnesota as more than a dozen water protectors locked themselves to construction vehicles at two work sites and to the pipeline itself. Just last month, 179 people were arrested. 1,000 shut down an Enbridge pumping station for 2 days as part of the Treaty People gathering. If completed, Line 3 would carry more than 750,000 barrels of Canadian tar sands oil a day across Indigenous land and fragile ecosystems. This is a Line 3 water protector who locked themselves to a horizontal directional drill and were arrested on felony theft charges.
Being charged with felony theft by a company that is actively stealing our clean water, our clean air, and our livable future. The state and Enbridge want us to be afraid. They have the money, they have the manpower, they have the courts to do their bidding. They want to bully us into believing their narrative that what we're doing here is wrong. If you think things can stay the way that they are, or that oppressed people's responses to the daily onslaught of violence that is life in the so-called U.S. Is too extreme, then you have made yourself an enemy of a just and habitable future.
This comes as dozens of Hubbard County sheriffs also barricaded the camp where water protectors are staying. The Enbridge Line 3 tar sands pipeline has the backing of the Biden administration. And this week, Indigenous leaders and climate justice activists blockaded access to the White House, calling on Biden to stop fossil fuel projects and invest in climate justice initiatives in his infrastructure plan. Meanwhile, two men working on construction of Enbridge's Line 3 oil pipeline have been arrested in Minnesota as part of a sex trafficking sting operation. For more, we go to Minnesota to speak with Tara Huska, Indigenous lawyer and activist, founder of the Ginu Collective. She's Ojibwe from Kuchiching First Nation. Tara, welcome back to Democracy Now! Just lay out the scope of this protest and what it is that you're protesting with Line 3, what it represents to you and what you hope to accomplish.
Good morning, Amy. Thanks for having me back. So what we're at basically is a all-out ground fight, people giving everything they have to defend this beautiful place and to stand up for future generations. I have seen over 500 people now passing through the legal systems in Minnesota, over 500 arrests through the cold winter, through a pandemic. To put that in scope, there were 800 arrests or 800 people arrested out in Standing Rock. So that's where we're at. Even though this resistance has not been 10,000 people, it has been something where we've seen young people especially really stepping up to the plate. This is their futures on the line. Seeing 20-year-olds crawling into pipes when it's 0 degrees outside, literally risking their own safety to stand up for their own futures and for someone yet to come. This, to me, is an extension of the fight that's happening all over Mother Earth, protecting the last beautiful places, protecting the sacred, as you were talking about at the beginning of the hour. Climate crisis is ravaging Mother Earth. The decisions that we've made as humankind are coming back to us. And this fight is happening in the meantime for these places, while the decision makers are talking, while the policy change is being pushed, while you have President Biden talking about him being a climate president. Line 3, Trans Mountain Pipeline, Oak Flat, all these other places that are fighting, the Ferry Creek blockades. It's happening all over Mother Earth that we are standing up and defending the sacred.
This is another water protector speaking from close to where you are right now, from the Line 3 resistance site.
We start like drilling on the rivers, you know, to touch a body of waters that are really important. It's an urgency to be here. This is important to be here, to put our bodies in the front line, to walk there, like we always say, with no fear, but with like the certainty that what we're doing is right. This is a struggle for love. This is a struggle for life, for people.
So if you can continue along the line of description that he's given, also, who owns Line 3? What's it supposed to do?
Enbridge owns Line 3. Enbridge plans to send almost 915,000 barrels a day of tar sands from Alberta down through the headwaters of the Mississippi River to the shore of Lake Superior. It plans to continue the expansion of the fossil fuel industry, the emissions equivalent of 50 coal-fired plants, and putting, just in this territory alone, over 800 wetlands, 200 water bodies, 22 rivers. That's what Enbridge seeks to contaminate with its tar sands. It is billing it as a replacement project. It is not a replacement project. It's a brand new pipeline and a brand new route. They want a new route because they want a new corridor. There is no pipelines in the places that we're talking about. There is nothing there. It is just pristine ecosystems. And that's what we're trying to protect. We are protecting the sacred. We are standing up for what's right. We have done so at enormous self-risk and enormous personal cost, but we do so because it is what's right. We are standing with the sacred, and we're willing to risk everything to do it.
You've been arrested. Can you describe that experience, and can you talk about the authorities and what they're doing, particularly dozens of Hubbard County sheriffs barricading the camp where water protectors are staying? But first, describe your experience.
Yeah, I was arrested back in the springtime. So myself and several other Native folks, including the one that spoke before, Victor, were in a sacred launch, and we were directly in the middle of a work site. We prayed, we sang, we shared prayers, and we were pulled out and we were arrested. Police then chose to cut apart our lodge after we were arrested. I was put into a kennel, I was strip searched, and when I was brought to Zoom court, they put us in belly chains. That's how they treated us, for misdemeanor charges. My experience has been that of many, many other water protectors who've been arrested throughout this struggle. And as far as the sheriff showing up at our doorstep on Monday, I mean, yeah, we're talking about egregious rights, or egregious violations of just basic property rights. They attempted to say that because there's a county, there's a little parcel of county land, 150 feet of it, with an easement on it held by Winona LaDuke, actually, that we don't have a right of access to it, that they've closed the county land and we can't access our private parcel by vehicles any longer. We have to walk on foot. But then they sent in a riot line of police and no one was leaving, no one was getting in. So 12 people were arrested in our driveway on Monday.
And what do you say to President Biden? He's approved this pipeline. I mean, he put a stop almost immediately to the Keystone XL pipeline. But when it comes to another pipeline that you were one of the leaders in protesting, Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota, and Enbridge 3, he's still fully supporting them.
Yeah, and Dakota Access Pipeline is running illegally right now at this very moment. And how many lives did that take? How many lives that irrevocably change, and the human rights crisis that was the fight at Dakota against Dakota Access Pipeline on the ground, the dog attacks and so many other egregious human rights violations that occurred there. and yet that pipeline is still running under a so-called climate president. The Biden administration has declined to intervene when it should, including in line three. There is a very clear road and pathway towards intervention, which is ordering a review of the water crossing permits issued under the Trump administration, all those wetlands I described, all those water bodies I described, to suspend this project and review those. So considering tribal cultural resources, considering climate crisis and climate emissions that come from this project, those have not been considered in the environmental impact statement that was done at the state level. That's what we're asking for. It's almost a playbook directly out of Dakota Access Pipeline resistance, which is order the EIS, at least do the review, and there's no way it's going to pass the test.
In your comments, as you alluded to earlier, about the weather catastrophe this country and Canada, not to mention the rest of the world, like Russia, are experiencing right now, a town has been wiped off the face of the map in Canada. Lytton, Canada, created its own climate with the heat above 120 degrees Fahrenheit, leading to a fire that just engulfed this town.
Yeah, and so here in Minnesota, we're experiencing extreme drought. The rivers and lakes are incredibly low. We're talking 5 feet low. And then you have pump trucks all over rivers, including the Mississippi River, pumping out what Enbridge now proposes. Originally, their ask was for 540 million gallons of water that they call dewatering, where they pull it out temporarily and then try to put it back into the ecosystem because it is such a wet area. They had to apply for a variance, 5 billion gallons of water. That's what they plan on pulling out of the wetlands in northern Minnesota while we are in extreme drought. So there are pump trucks all over the rivers, all over the lakes, and they're pulling water out and loading into trucks and mixing drilling mud to drill under our rivers and expand the fossil fuel industry. I've seen rice beds that are completely bone dry and bare, and seeing something like that and knowing what's happening around the globe, knowing that right here in Minnesota, we set records almost every day of June because it is so hot, and here we are expanding the fossil fuel industry. Here is, you know, the mainstream society choosing to engage in self-destruction. That's what's happening, and it's happening in real time. And in the meantime, there are people who are pushing for something different, and we are risking everything to do it.
Tara, I want to bring a second person into this conversation. I want to go from Nemawag Camp, where you are in northern Minnesota, to South Dakota. This week, the Republican governor there, Kristi Noem, announced she's deploying 50 members of the South Dakota National Guard to the U.S.-Mexico border at the request of Texas Governor Greg Abbott. But there's a twist. The deployment is being paid for by billionaire Republican megadonor Willis Johnson, who lives in Tennessee. Some critics have accused Noem of turning the National Guard into a private mercenary force targeting migrants. Our next guests obtained documents that indicate this same force, the South Dakota National Guard, will be deployed to suppress land and water defenders resisting pipelines. We are also joined by Bruce Ellison, water protector and land back attorney in Rapid City. Can you talk about, Bruce, what these documents show that you've gotten a hold of?
Good morning, Amy. Thank you for having me on. Essentially, what seems to be evolving is not just the militarization of our police forces, but particularly the active deployment and involvement of National Guard troops in the suppression of resistance to fossil fuel industry and other activities. And that's aside from the private use referenced earlier. Where are we going with this? Essentially, the documents that we got had to do with plans for the now ended KXL pipeline and how the South Dakota National Guard was going to be the main force to ensure that the pipeline, 315 miles, was constructed and that they would be guarding not only construction operations, but also equipment, and interestingly enough, including the use of lethal force. So what we're finding is that—
Wait. Can you talk more about what that means? The South Dakota National Guard and kill people to protect a pipeline?
Essentially, yes, they can. It can be used to defense of others, of course, but also defense of property. And the standards have to do with if other means cannot reasonably be used to stop destruction of property or someone who's leaving, believed to have destroyed property, lethal force can be used. What's happening is that we look at an evolution from, say, Standing Rock, where the National Guard played a role. They manned checkpoints. They drove trucks around with food and other equipment. That has then evolved to current plans or for the KXL pipeline, which would be active deployment. I mean, these would be not only so-called civil disorder forces, but they would be backed up by regular troops who would be armed with automatic weapons. This was deployed a little bit about a year ago around the protest near Mount Rushmore when Trump was visiting by land-backed people who were trying to raise issues, as I said, near Mount Rushmore. We saw that real first combination of the active use of the military from being in the back to being in the front.
So from South Dakota up to northern Minnesota, Tarahouska, is this the first you're hearing of this? Does it surprise you? And can you talk about not only the National Guard being used, but the role of U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents in dealing with the Line 3 water protector protesters?
I have to say, I'm not super surprised. Actually, there was just a bill, H.R. 1374, the Energy Policy and Security Act, that just passed the House. And it essentially provides both a method for private actors, private industry, to directly work with states and create energy security policy. And it also provides federal funding for states to create energy security plans, specifically around critical infrastructure, which includes pipelines and extractive industry. It seems like it's basically like responding directly to situations like the Enbridge Corporation here in Minnesota, which is engaged in a public safety escrow trust where it's paying our police directly to, it's incentivizing our police to target, harass, surveil water protectors and reimburse them for all the costs of doing so. That's why we see 50, 60 squad cars here on a dirt road. Blockading us in our driveway. I mean, they're getting paid by the company to do it. And as far as the National Guard and all that and the militarization goes, I mean, we've seen Customs Border Patrol drones over our camp for years. There's been Customs, Department of Homeland Security helicopters over protests. There's been Department of Homeland Security helicopters over our private property, our encampment. It's something where you're seeing a very concerted effort to surveil, harass, and target indigenous-led movement.
Before I ask you a slightly different question about what has happened throughout Canada, yesterday being the Canada Day protests, let me ask you about these sex trafficking charges. What do you know about them? Two men working on the Enbridge Line 3 charged with sex trafficking.
I know that it's the second sex trafficking ring that's been busted that's had Enbridge employees in it in the months that they've been here in our territory. I know that we told and warned the state, we warned the governor and Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan that this would happen, and it did. A 30-minute training or even a day training to employees is just not enough. These people are here in our state. They're mostly from out of state. There's 5,000 mostly out of state workers here constructing Line 3. They are growing increasingly aggressive. Actually, yesterday at the demonstration, one of the workers attempted to drive a vehicle running over protesters on site. These people are here to destroy the territory. They are not interested in developing relationships or being accountable to our communities because they're not.
Finally, the protests all over Canada Thursday on Canada Day following the recent discovery of graves and remains of First Nations children at government-run schools. Tara, you are Ojibwe from the Kochiching First Nation. Can you talk about this?
It is a it's a gut punch that I think a lot of us already knew. But it's hard still to see those numbers and to know all those lives and all those generations that are missing, all those voices and people that belong to us that were taken by the residential schools and by the boarding school era. I mean, I think it's a very stark reminder of what we have to come to terms with in terms of looking at the treatment of Indigenous people, both by Canada and the United States and around the world, the attempts to eradicate us and the continued efforts to do so through out-of-home placement of children and, you know, destruction of our land, our territories, theft of so many different aspects of our people.
Tara Hauska, I want to thank you for being with us. That does it for our show. Indigenous lawyer and activist, founder of the Ginu Collective, and also Bruce Ellison, water protector and land back attorney. I'm Amy Goodman. Have a good weekend. Be safe.
And that was Democracy Now! With coverage about the Enbridge Line 3 tar sands pipeline construction, which is happening in northern Minnesota, and the large resistance against it, you know, with echoes of Standing Rock. And if you want to find out more, go to democracynow.org. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. So up next, we feature a bit of a press conference that was done online through CPAC with the Assembly of First Nations Chief Perry Bellegard on the call for the papal apology on residential schools. So here, Perry, he begins with some opening remarks, and then there are some questions from journalists about the meeting that he has secured with the Pope to discuss an official papal apology on residential schools in Canada.
Thank you all for coming and for listening, and the comments I want to make are related to the papal apology and the trip to the Vatican coming up in December. In 2015, you know, our Assembly of First Nations embraced all 94 calls to action from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, including call to action number 58, which is speaking to the need for a papal apology here in Canada. As well, in 2018, the Chiefs of Canada by resolution again called, or renewed its call for a papal apology in addressing call to action number 58. And so at the AFN, we've been working on this for a number of years now to get this planned and organized. And it's now confirmed that on December 17th, of 2021 and December 18th of 2021 and December 20th of 2021 in the Vatican, that there will be a delegation from Canada going. A delegation made up of AFN, Assembly of First Nations representatives, from the MNC and ITK as well. And so that's confirmed. And it's all part of reconciliation. It's all part of healing. But it's really focusing on TRC call to action number 58 for the full implementation of that. And I'll leave it at that. We'll start looking at taking some questions from the media.
Yep, go ahead. Okay, thank you. National Chief, thank you for your time this afternoon. I do have a question for you. I would like to start with the finding out of from the Lower Kootenai Band today of just under 200 unmarked burial sites discovered at the former St. Eugene Residential School. Wondering what your reaction is to that. And we spoke to the chief of this band just this morning, and he compared the findings to Nazi war crimes. And I'm wondering what role you think the Justice Department at the federal government's level should have in prosecuting anybody who's responsible for this.
Well, thanks for the question, Olivia. And you know, not only like from today, the new find, there's 215 at Kamloops, the 751 unmarked graves at Cowessess, and now the 180 plus at Cranbrook. And again, we have 139 sites across Canada where the residential schools were. And each and every one of those sites needs to be investigated properly. And this is a validation of what the survivors have been saying, that there are unmarked graves and that there has been death in these institutions. And some of them are like mass graves. Some of them are just unmarked graves. And so you have to do the proper research and investigation at every site to make sure that there is proper research done, proper investigation, and proper redress for commemoration of this. And so in some sites, some people will be saying, and each one will be different. You know, at some sites, if they're fresh, the RCMP may be called. Some have called for the RCMP to possibly investigate crime scenes. And so, again, elevating this to a national, international level is very important. That helps put appropriate pressure on the powers to be. But the focus is on getting the research done, the investigation done, and the proper commemorations done. The whole system of residential schools was a genocide. I've called it that. And we see the intergenerational traumas and feel the effects to this day. And so that's where it rests.
Thank you. And as a follow-up on the meetings with the Pope that are scheduled for December, I'm wondering, first of all, if you will be attending as part of this delegation, since you will no longer be national chief, of course, at that time. And secondly, would you like to see the Catholic Church do anything specific in the lead up to these meetings, such as fulfilling the settlement of $25 million to survivors, for example, as per the residential school settlement agreement, or releasing all documents related to residential schools? Do you need to see the church do anything before these meetings take place?
Again, it's all preparation. We are open-minded as well to forming a working group within the Assembly of First Nations to finalize details in terms of the delegation. So everything is a work in progress, working up to December 17th, 18th meetings at the Vatican. So those details have yet to be finalized. As far as preparation from the Roman Catholic Church, I would just keep urging them all to do as much as they can to start sharing data and documents and information and anything that they can to help provide the information to these grave sites that are there, like who is there. You know, if they have records, that they should be openly accessible. So that would be the only message to the Catholic Church, is to do that piece and sharing data and records that they have right across Canada. And that would be the message going forward. And again, the preparation and planning for the December meeting will always be a work in progress. And there will be a committee formed here at AFN to finalize the details going forward.
Okay, Stephanie Taylor, Canadian Press.
Thank you so much for your time, National Chief. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Excellent. I'm wondering why do yourself and perhaps others think the Catholic Church or the Vatican has perhaps changed their mind or might be open to delivering a papal apology, because they have not to date in past delegations, they haven't even with news of more of these discoveries. So what makes you or perhaps others think that that anything has changed in their position?
Well, to date, the Anglican Church has apologized. The Presbyterian Church has apologized. United Church has apologized. And this is really part of truth and be part of the healing and reconciliation process for survivors to hear the apology from the highest position within the Roman Catholic Church, which is the Pope. And our hope and prayer is we can only implement the direction from our chiefs in assembly. And the chiefs in assembly have been clear. Accept TRC calls to action. Focus on call to action number 58. And it's very clear what 58 says, is to approach the Vatican and His Holiness and try to bring him to Canada, so that he can make an apology directly to the survivors and their families here on Canadian soil. The government and the church are complicit with the implementation of the residential schools. And so they need to both acknowledge their role. And I think the Vatican and the Roman Catholic Church, they made apologies to the Irish people. They made apologies to the indigenous people in Bolivia. And so I think the spirit will move in the appropriate way at the appropriate time when things happen here in Canada.
Thanks very much as well, National Chief. I'm interested to get your reaction to reports we're seeing of Catholic churches being burned or being vandalized. And do you have any concern from leaders that are characterizing what is happening to these churches as hate crimes?
Well, I can understand the frustration and the anger by people. And I would say that burning things down is not the way to proceed. I would say building things up would be the better way to proceed and build relationships. I can understand the frustration, the anger, and the hurt and the pain. There's no question. But to burn things down is not our way. our way is to build relationship.
Okay, Kieran at Global News.
Hello, Kieran D, Global News. Thank you for your time, National Chief. In light of this moment that we're in with today's discovery in Cranbrook and others in recent weeks, how do you feel that Canada Day should be recognized this year and in the future?
Well, I think in light of the, thank you for the question. In light of the discovery at Kamloops and Cowessess and Cranbrook today, Canada Day is here. It's just that it will be marked in a different way. And instead of the huge fireworks and celebration, I think the day will be marked by somber reflection, somber thought, thoughts of reconciliation, thoughts of partnership, thoughts of having difficult dialogues on how we can move forward together to build a better country and be free from discrimination, racism against all peoples, and in particular First Nations people. And I think that's how the day should go forward. It's an education awareness time. It's Canadians have really opened their minds and hearts. Those 215 young people's spirits have woken up everybody, not only in Canada, but the world, about the need to work together and not forget the harm and the hurt and the death that happened here. So Canada Day will be here. It is Canada's Day. But again, it'll be marked in a different way. And I think it can be marked in a very powerful way, a very special way, a very spiritual way, in how we move forward together to acknowledge the truth that happened and move forward on a reconciliation path together.
And that was part of a press conference that was recently held by the Assembly of First Nations Chief Perry Bellegarde on the call for a papal apology on residential schools. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. And to close out the show, we're going to feature an interview from our archives. And I've played this interview on the show a number of times, but it's still an interview that I really have always been proud of and have enjoyed listening to. And it's my interview with David Suzuki after he came out with his autobiography. And so this was back in 2006. And we met at the CKUT studios and did an interview about his life, because his autobiography had just come out. And so the segment that I'm going to play from the interview is primarily about his history, his life, and less about maybe what we were discussing at the time that had more relevance back in 2006. This is really just featuring David Suzuki talking about growing up, getting into broadcast journalism, and the environmental movement, and so on. So enjoy that. And so we're going to start, we're going to pick it up, the interview, right from where he's discussing his relationship with his father and how his father instilled in him a love for the great outdoors and so on.
And as the eldest son in the family, he was told by his parents, you've got to go out, work hard, and make money. Because money to them meant security. And I was always grateful that my dad never followed their instructions. And I used to say, Dad, you're my mutant. You know, you somehow mutated away from those values. Because he always taught us, you have to work hard in order to make money because you need the necessities in life. But you don't run after money as an end in itself. And I can remember as a boy, we used to visit his parents every week, and they used to bawl him out all the time. You know, why did you take David camping on the weekend when you should have been working and making money? You know, you're just taking too much time off. And for me, my dad was my big hero, and I resented it very much what my grandparents were telling him. And he taught us, you know, that you should pity people that brag about how much money they're making or their fancy clothes or their big cars. Because he said they've got off on the wrong tangent. That's not what life is all about. So I've always been grateful to him for that. But the big thing that he loved was the outdoors. And he took me camping. My earliest memories are of camping when I was 4 years old. And he took me fishing. His great love was fishing. And that stayed with me all my life. But it was through fishing and camping that I came to understand our need for nature. We all have that built into us. Most of us now live in cities. And what I see is, when kids come in, often they might have a little bottle with, you know, a worm or a spider or caterpillar. And I see the parents going, take that out of here, you know, like teaching them to be afraid or to feel disgust towards nature. I think my dad was the great influence in my life, but my mother did something so wonderful for me. When I was in London, Ontario, we moved there in 1949. I was a teenager by then, and I had girls on the brain. Like, that's all I thought about was girls. And fortunately, there was a very big swamp near our house. And I'd ride my bike over to the swamp. And the minute I could walk into the swamp, I'd forget all about girls, because the swamp is a magical place. And I'd, you know, I had a net and a bottle, and I'd dip all kinds of things in. And I'd come home covered in mud and soaking wet. My mother never, ever said, stay out of the house. Don't come in with your wet clothes. She would let me come in, just slop all over the floor. And every time I held out my jar with, you know, she'd look at it and go, oh, you've got salamander eggs. I've never seen them before. Isn't that wonderful? And she acted as if what I was doing was the most wonderful thing. And that support of my love of nature was a great gift from my mother as well.
Wow. Now, I guess, as a naturalist growing up, you learned all kinds of things. The whole world was open up to you. Do you still have time to learn other new things about the natural world today?
I learn all kinds of things. And the wonderful part of it today is that I'm learning it through my children. My two youngest children, one's an ethnobotanist. So she's studying the way that First Nations people on the West Coast used plants. She's just opened up a whole area to me now. I didn't realize that Native people on the West Coast actually farmed clams. They had what they call clam gardens, and they would build little areas right at low tide where the sand and shells and things could wash in and gradually fill up an area, and the clams would grow in there. Through my daughter, she's now studying the role that eelgrass plays. Eelgrass is one of those keystone species, and it's in the intertidal areas. Lots of fish lay their eggs in eelgrass. Squid come in and lay their eggs, and it's a very important, critical species. And it turns out that the First Nations ate eelgrass. And they actually cultivated eelgrass from the way that they harvested it. So there's a whole other area, the interaction of traditional peoples and the environment. You know, we Europeans came to British Columbia, and they thought these savages, you know, they don't know anything. But the fact is, they were actually gardening animals, growing animals and plants. So fortunately, my world is still wide open to discovery.
That's great. Another naturalist, John Livingston, that was behind a lot of, the team behind you at the Nature of Things for some years. Could you describe maybe to me what kind of effect he had on your own thinking?
Well, Jake was a very tough guy. You know, he was he didn't suffer fools easily, and a lot of people had a difficult time getting along with him. And he and I, in fact, we didn't always see eye to eye. For example, I was very involved with the anti-nuclear movement, and he used to say to me, what are you bothering that for? And I said, well, you know, I think this represents a tremendous threat, the buildup of the arms race. I mean, surely you're interested in that. And he said, if we're so stupid that we're going to blow ourselves up, the sooner the better. And he really was almost a misanthrope in that, you know, he felt that humans had got off on this very destructive path and destroyed birds. He was an avid birder, and he just hated the way that humans were destroying the natural world. But what Jake did for me that was so important, I had come in thinking that humans were at the center of the action, and that really our dealing with the natural world was a statement about what we valued, that another species was important to me because humans were so aware and intelligent that we were the ones that could appreciate what a beautiful thing that was and leave it alone. And so I thought that we had to focus on humans. We're at the center of the action. What Jake had was a very different approach, and that is humans are just one species out of maybe 30 million, and that it's the whole focus on human beings as a center of the action that had got us into the problem in the first place. So where I was taking an anthropotropic position, that humans were at the center, he took a biocentric position that humans were just a part of a much greater whole. And that was a very, very important thing for me to shift that that vision.
Mm. Wow. Now, you did a lot of television work, obviously, with The Nature of Things. You were also the first voice of Quirks and Quarks, the CBC radio program about science. And you say in your book that radio was really your favorite medium, and why is that?
Well, it's a wonderful medium because, first of all, you create all of the images in the listener's head. And basically, the listener does all the work for you, you know. And with just through sound and words, you know, I can talk about things that couldn't... Spike Jonze did a wonderful thing on this. You could show a clip about this, you know. And through sound, he created this vision where you had a whole army of people and planes flying through the air and dropping stuff in a giant mound of whipped cream and, you know, like all of that. You just have to say it and someone creates it in their own head. Yeah. And that's the beauty of radio is that everybody listens and they do the work for you. It's just a matter of getting it out. And the other thing I love is that because radio can be easily edited, you know, you can go through miles and miles of tape and then just cut out what you need. And it's a very warm, you and I could sit there and as we get to know each other, you know, you forget all about the microphones and we're just talking. And there's just a warmth and a closeness that you can't get on television. Television, every minute is so important that it's all got to be designed and set up. Every shot has got to be lit the right way. So it becomes a complete artificial situation. Then you put the person in. Well, you can't let them just rattle off and tell jokes and all that sort of stuff. They got to deliver the line that you want. And so it's a completely contrived kind of medium, whereas radio is much more warm and natural.
Now, you've been involved in the Canadian university environment for some time as a professor and, you know, dating back, I guess, to the early 60s. What kind of changes have you seen in the Canadian universities?
You know, I haven't been teaching now for, well, over 20 years. But certainly I feel looking at high school students, they're every bit as idealistic and excitable as students were when I was in high school. What I think the terrible aspect of what's happened to the universities is that the universities have made a terrible bargain for money. To me, a university is a very, very special place in our society. It's a place where you have scholars and dreamers and students all coming together to explore ideas at the very cutting edge of human thought. It's a very exciting place. The problem is when you've got scholars and dreamers and artists dreaming, often the ideas they're playing with are threatening to society. I mean, where was Das Kapital born? But in a university. And it's not an accident that when you look at around the world, many revolutions have started in the university. And because of that, there is a lot of pressure always from society to shut those damn professors up. You know, they shouldn't be teaching our kids these things. And what we've done in our wisdom is given professors tenure. And tenure is not a job guarantee. It is meant as a protection so that scholars can explore ideas and not worry that someone's going to come in and fire them. And to me, tenure was a great liberating thing. When I got tenure, I now knew I had qualified as a scholar to be a part of the university community. And I felt I now had the responsibility to speak out about topics that I knew something about. And I could do that without fear of getting fired. A lot of people now regard tenure as just job security. Once they got tenure, they don't have to worry about anything else. But the terrible thing that's happened is that universities, in order to get more funding, have welcomed the private sector into the university. Indeed, you know, you look at the University of Wisconsin, they were co-partners in a discovery of a chemical called warfarin, which kills rats. And I think warfarin stands for Wisconsin Agricultural Research Fund or something. And because of they were involved with that professor, they've got millions and millions of dollars from that one discovery. So universities welcomed when biotechnology happened. They welcomed biotechnology into their halls. But the result of that was you begin to set up private companies. Suddenly, the openness and collegiality of the community disappeared. Now students who were working in those labs couldn't speak out because of they wanted to patent those ideas. Suddenly, professors who are working in biotechnology or genetic engineering don't want to talk anything critical or about the area. And so it's changed. The university is no longer that area of radical thought and free exchange. You know, we did a show after the Arab oil embargo in 1974. We decided to do a show on Alberta tar sands because there was only one plant. Syncrude was present then. It was putting out 50 tons of sulfur dioxide a day. That's a lot of acid rain. The premier of Alberta, Peter Lougheed, was talking about building 10 more plants bigger than Syncrude. That's a lot of acid rain. So we went to the University of Alberta in Edmonton, lots of ecologists. None of them would talk to us on camera. Went to the University of Calgary, lots of ecologists. None of them would talk to us on camera. Why? They were all getting grants from the oil industry. So then you say, wait a minute, what's going on? This is an area of great concern to the public. You're an ecologist. You could tell us what the implications are. You're not going to tell us? What the hell are you doing in the university then? You don't deserve tenure. I think it's a very, very destructive thing for the universities to get into bed with the private sector because it's not the same thing as it used to be.
I know in your book you talk about a change in thinking from back in, and I remember in the late 80s, this is what we always heard of think globally, act locally.
Yeah.
And you changed your thinking to think locally and act locally.
I used to run around like everybody else saying think globally, act locally. But over time, I began to realize when ordinary people think globally and think about things like global warming or species extinction, they go, oh, my God, it's so huge. And who the hell am I? I'm just one person out of 6 billion. I'm nothing. I'm insignificant. So rather than empowering people, that slogan disempowered them by imbuing a sense of helplessness. And that's why I really do think that it's at the local level that you can get involved and actually see the chance of doing something. So I say think locally and act locally. And that's the only way that we will have an effect globally, when a lot of people are working at the local level. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be have people thinking about the big picture. We've always got to be thinking about the big picture. But for most people, I think it's far more profitable to get involved in stopping spraying in the schoolyard or, you know, Montreal, I know now, has no pesticides. And I know one of the people that was critical in that was a woman named Esther Goldenberg. And boy, you know, she just worked tirelessly over years and years. And by God, she got it done. And I think that's where people can feel, wow, I can actually achieve something.
You have a summer place on one of the islands off of Vancouver Island. I believe it's called Tangwyn.
Yeah, we call it Tangwyn.
You call it Tangwyn?
Yeah, place of blessed peace.
Okay. And just maybe put into perspective for me, I know you really like fishing, put into perspective how the ocean ecosystems have changed over the years.
Well, this is a terrible aspect. You know, we live in Vancouver, and when we go to our cottage on Quadra Island, we have to take two ferries. We go to Vancouver Island, drive 2 hours, and then take another ferry over to our island. And as we get closer to our island, the last ferry, we can see these boils of herring and huge bundles and eagles diving down to catch them and salmon leaping all over. And we go, oh, it's so great to be back in nature, you know, the way it always was. Then I talk to my neighbor, Dan LeClaire, who's lived on Quadra for over 60 years. And when he describes what it was like when he moved there, you just want to weep because, you know, he said, when I was a kid, you used to be able to go out in a little punt, a little rowboat, and with a rake, a garden rake, you'd go to the kelp beds and rake herring into your punt, and you could fill it in 15 minutes. They were that abundant. He said we could go out any time and catch a red snapper. Ling cod and rock cod were just, you could, any time you could pull one up for a meal. Well, the fact is the herring near our place were wiped out in one commercial fishery for 1 year. They were wiped out. He said that the salmon used to be so numerous that you could hear them coming miles away. They were jumping as they were approaching the island. You could hear them coming. You knew when they were coming. We've never heard any of that. If I look at what the oceans were when Dan LeClaire was there, I inherited the property. I got the property. It was already empty. But even in that time, the fish that we were relying on, the ling cod and rock cod, they've gone.
And that was an excerpt from an interview I did back in 2006 with Dr. David Suzuki, who, of course, is the famous scientist, broadcaster, host of CBC, The Nature of Things.
and the author of many books, and also one of the founders of the David Suzuki Foundation, one of the most important environmental groups working in Canada today. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. And we're basically out of time, so thanks for listening. You can always email us at ecolibrium@ckut.ca. You can always check us out on Facebook. Look for Ecolibrium CKUT Montreal. And we do have a podcast with occasional interviews that you hear on the show called the Ecolibrium Radio Podcast. And so just search for that in Spotify and you can find it. And you can follow me on Twitter at Ryan V. Young. And that's about it. So thanks for listening. Now is the time when we start to hear cicadas singing in the trees. If you want to be reminded what a cicada sounds like, here's the sound. And actually, in and around Montreal, and in basically all of southern Quebec, it's really one species of cicada, and that's the dog day cicada. And I think a cicada in French is called a cigale. And so here's a song that has cicadas in the title, and it's by Feist. And this is from her Metals album, which I believe came out in 2011, and it's called Cicadas and Gulls. Enjoy.
Quebec, vaccination against COVID-19 is underway, but not everybody is protected yet. Even if you've been vaccinated, you still need to respect basic health measures, like wearing a mask, maintaining social distancing, and washing your hands regularly. You must also get tested if you have symptoms and follow self-isolation guidelines. Find out about the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Follow all the health guidelines, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
University, I pull it up in Mercury. Mama, how we filled up with bags of Hercules. Soon as I finish pissing, I put the seat down. Oh, my mama be done, come on, day in my retire. Only child, no siblings, no besties. I couldn't do nothing right like a lefty. Bought my mama first house with the jewel, man. Bought my mama second house with the club, man. Me and mama used to chop out the same house. Used to eat and go to sleep on the same couch. Me and mama got busted at the same time. When the court and told you the damn same lies, I can tell mama proud of her only son. Two chains, I have always worn more than one. Yeah, I'm real, I'm ill, you know you gotta feel. You popping pill, I'm real, that $2 bill. Yeah, I'm just trying to make my mama proud. Yeah, I ain't trying to let my mama down. Yeah, I'm just trying to make my mama proud. Yeah, I ain't trying to let my mama down. Yeah, mama ain't raised no one time. Yeah, my mama ain't raised no.
Mama ain't raised no, no. Cause my mama ain't no, no. My mama ain't raised no, no. Drop a P and NT, we at your door. Getting on the floor. They cold hearted, so you gotta do it cold. These and my mama can't get it wrong. Cause my mama.